Webcasting to the world, live, the good news of God's righteousness for all humanity. This is the Gospel Revolution Radio Network. Greetings, you beautiful humans. This is Glenn Klein online. It's Hump Day, Wednesday, September 30th, 2009. The only last day of September 2009 in the history of humanity. Welcome in on this final night of September. Glad to have you along for the ride wherever you're logging in, whether it be live or on the archive. We are glad to have you in the midweek edition of Glenn Klein Online, the Gospel Revolution webcast. And very glad to be able to welcome the president and founder of said revolution, Mr. Michael Williams from Houston, Texas. Michael!
Good evening, Brother Glenn. How are you today?
How's the most holy reverend?
Well, the most holy reverend is still just as holy and just as reverend. Did I ever tell you why I, many years ago, I refused to take the term reverend?
Was that pre-gospel or post-gospel?
Yeah, no, it was pre.
You would not accept the reverend title.
The reason I would never accept the reverend title, being the teacher researcher that I am, I had to find out whether or not it was scriptural or not. And so I did a word search on the term reverend, and the only time it showed up was in reference to God. And it said, "Holy and reverend is the Lord." And I thought, I don't think I qualify. So every place that invited me would want to introduce me as the Reverend Michael Williams, and I never, ever, ever took on that title from the earliest of years.
Wow, so even in the Word of Faith days, you were contemplating things like that.
Oh yes, yeah. Things that were just accepted for face value that we were just told. I really had a very strong need to find out, you know, where that came from and why do we do this and why do we do that and so yeah. Been a little rebel for a long time, I guess.
And now you are a rebel with a cause.
I do have a cause, and that cause has, I think, is a the best cause I could come up with for being a rebel, and that is the same reason that the Protestant movement started, which. The term Protestant comes from the word protest, and so they are Protestants, but they don't protest anything anymore except people's morals is about the only thing the Protestants protest anymore. But they originally protested the main thrust of the Protestant movement was rejecting the authority of the Pope or any human being as a mediator between God and man from the Catholic Church. So that was the onset of the Protestants. I don't know if they found other things to protest or not, but. That was definitely
The interesting thing, of course, is that the Protestant movement developed its own sets or own series of popes themselves to the point now where each individual pastor is considered the covering for an individual or respective congregation. And so if you are without a pastor, you are, quote-unquote, underneath or out from underneath a covering.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, during the heyday of the Word of Faith movement and charismatic movement, One of the budding branches of that was the shepherding movement, which I'm sure that you remember some of. And
right.
It was Derek Prince and, the other names just escape me at the moment. You might be able to come up with them. But
I think Mike Bickle from Kansas City was involved in that.
Yeah.
It was literally called the shepherding movement.
The shepherding movement. And it literally taught that all decisions, it wasn't that you had to meet, they mediated for God, but they were the shepherds of the flock, and you had to clear everything with these guys. I mean, it got to the point where that they were having to ask them, you know, permission to buy a car or to invest or anything.
Right. Well, they did it under the guise that these, and that filtered into our congregation in Wisconsin, and it was under the guise of, well, there's wisdom here so that you do not make decisions that you would regret.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, no, there was always very noble reasons. I mean, there's been noble reasons for the conquest and noble reasons for everything, I think. But there was a perfectly logical reason for it that we should take advantage of. It was for our good, not for them. This was a burden on them, but they were willing to bear the burden of being in control of our lives because they loved us so much. So, thankfully, in that particular movement, I think most all of its leaders recanted that theology over the years. I know one of them, which I cannot recall his name. I know Bob Mumford.
Right, that was the name, yeah.
Bob Mumford was one of them. And, you know, his son was converted to the gospel, and Bob was listening to my tapes and stuff. I actually went and spoke at Bob's son's house in North Carolina. I cannot remember his first name now. Yeah, no, this has just been a few years ago. Well, it seems like just a few years ago. I think it might have been in this decade. It may have been in the late 90s. I don't know. Just yesterday is now 10 years ago. But anyway, in fairly recent history of the gospel revolution, anyway. And but I went and spoke for him a couple of times there. So it was probably about 2000, somewhere around there, that I was there at the Mumford's house. And and his son told me that he and his father listened to one of my tapes every Tuesday together, and that his father was changing his mind about a lot of things. So I lost contact with him over the years for different reasons, but it'd be great to know what's going on there, because you know, the gospel just has a way of making inroads without your help. You know, just as long as it's out there, it'll do its own thing. It's really quite amazing.
One might think that God is somehow involved with it.
They
could. Speaking of the great state of Wisconsin and our church in Wisconsin, as I was, we have online our Wisconsin Gospel Revolution correspondent, Mr. Pep Washburn. Pep!
Rabbi!
How are you?
And Michael.
Peppy!
I'm really good. I'm actually cold. We had a 27-degree night last night.
You better bring the petunias in on that night.
Yeah, that's a froster on this morning. Listen, I'm
calling. It was so chilly here this morning that one of Dawn's clients, when I say chilly, it was like in the 60s this morning here.
Oh, brr.
But there was a bit of a nip in the air. The humidity was cut a little bit. And one of Dawn's clients' daughters said to her mom this morning, "Mom, it's so cold it might snow."
Well, you Southern wussies, you guys aren't real men anymore.
Men. Wonderful men.
Hey, Michael.
Yes.
Speaking of that, I'm thinking, you know, about having you up here to Wisconsin in a few months. I'm thinking about January. It's nice and cold then. How about coming
Well, you're
going
to have to get in line, Pep, because you scheduled to go to Calgary in January, the crazy dude.
Okay, well, I'll figure something out. Hey, I've
Maybe
called
February.
In with, I think it's going to end up being two questions. I'll just ask the first one here and then see if it leads into the second set of questions. Most of the religions of the world, and there are some exceptions, but most of them focus or have focused heavily on sacrifice of living creature, either animal or human, in order to appease or attain some favor from God or the gods. Obviously, it's a central tenet of Christianity, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on why this was or is so universal. No matter where you went, you know, there was the concept of blood sacrifice. What are your thoughts on that? Why is that so universal?
Well, I think that, for me, the answer is quite simple. Of course, you know, I rely heavily on two aspects of truth of the scriptures. And one is man's God imputing sin. And then the second most important thing in relationship to God that's ever happened to the human race is God imputing righteousness. And as we know from Paul's teaching, that even those that were not under the law, they became a law unto themselves. And he said that they went around accusing and excusing. So the issue of a guiltiness before God was, according to the teachings of the scriptures and Paul's agreement also, was imputed to the human race. So the need to satisfy their guiltiness, I think, is more an attempt to satisfy their guiltiness rather than to satisfy, quote, an angry God, even though that was their perception. That it was an angry God they were trying to deal with. So,
and that guiltiness, Michael, was apparently pandemic throughout the human race, regardless
absolutely.
Of what their religious persuasion was at the time.
Whether they were taught the scriptures or they knew anything about any Adam or not, whether or not they ever knew anything about the law of God, the condition was still there, and of course God did not give the law to an entire planet. He gave the law just to the Jewish people, just to take a sampling, if you will, and took a really great and mighty people, the Hebrew people, and imposed his law on them so that they could demonstrate to the rest of the planet the impossibility of meriting God's favor or avoiding his disapproval through the keeping of even God's own laws. But even though God only chose the Jewish people to set the world stage, if you will, and for them to carry this out on the stage of the world, the entire world was affected, according to what I'm able to deduce from the scriptures and Paul's teachings, was that the condition of sin was imputed to the entire human race. So when I see other cultures calling for sacrifices You know, there's a lot of people who discount even the work of the cross because other cultures came up with this. I know that that was the path that Carlton went down, Carlton Pearson, my friend, but he went down the path of doubting the reality of the cross because there were other cultures that sacrificed. There were other cultures that talked about a virgin birth. There were other cultures that had these things in them. But see, none of that surprises me at all. If this truly was an imputed condition of the human heart, that man would be searching for the ways, which was revealed by the scriptures, but still searching for the ways to rectify that when it was in the plan. Their actions and deeds were in the plan of God. They just didn't know what the plan was. And so they carried out these things, this, and they did claim virgin birth. They there was something intuitive, I think, in the entire human race that knew that there was something that would merit a huge change if there was a, quote, virgin birth.
So, and if there was a sacrifice.
Yes, and the sacrifices, for sure.
You know, if there's any legitimacy to what science now tells us about the fact that we all came from an original couple, this was literally passed down, the guilt of that event at the Garden of Eden was passed down through the DNA of everybody.
Yes, and you know, one of the things, Pep, that I've that I has really been intriguing to me, and I know probably has for you, you've probably studied some on this, but and that is the I've talked about it with a few friends who do more extensive study in these areas of DNA, but the theory that DNA also does not just carry genetic material, but that DNA has a, quote, memory, if you will, and that memory that is carried in can actually produce some of the actions and reactions that we have. Just like, see, I totally believe, now with imputed righteousness, I believe just the same as everyone after Adam was born with that that awful awareness of the sin condition, as it's spoken of as. I believe that everyone comes into this world now with an intuitive knowledge of righteousness. I actually remember it as a child before anyone ever told me anything. And how many people that I remember it, I remember testimonies way back in the church days of people giving their testimony about when they got saved. However, they always had the presence of God in their life. They remembered as children being in the, you know, being in the garden, being outside, just playing with their toys, and just this incredible awareness of just God and them being totally at peace with God without having to go through a salvation experience. So those things are all very interesting as far as DNA is concerned, but on the spiritual side of it, the implications are that if on both cases, on both sides of this issue of imputed sin and then imputed righteousness, which the correlation between those two leave us with the most profound realities about righteousness, and that is taking the conclusion about imputed sin. And, you know, we've challenged that with the evangelical community for many years now, is how that they very easily embrace the sin of one causing sin to be imputed to everyone, even those who had no knowledge of Adam whatsoever or of sin. And but yet then when it comes time for us to understand the gospel, and even though the very same term is used as imputed righteousness, that righteousness has to be believed for, or righteousness has to be attained to or worked on, or any combination, as you know, that many churches place on this issue of righteousness and holiness in the eyes of God. So, yeah, I'm not surprised that other cultures came up with their own solution if indeed sin consciousness was imputed to the entire human race.
That's very good, very interesting. I have a friend who is deals with a lot of psychology. He's a psychologist, and he discusses often the idea of genetic memory and how that is a growing field of study.
Oh, really?
And so yeah, this does lead me then to a couple questions. So then, why do you think a death sacrifice, you know, the shedding of blood specifically, was necessary? And what is the transcendent teaching behind a blood sacrifice?
Now, what do you mean by transcending teaching? You mean we see from other cultures?
No, the deeper teaching, or if you will, the higher teaching behind the actual blood sacrifice. Why blood? What is the typology that the blood is supposed to show us? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, and the only answer that I have for that is that is what the scriptures taught us, and that is that the life is in the blood. So that's the typology that we would have in that is implications that were given in the five books of Moses.
Okay. Yes.
And even from the first blood that was shed, was the blood of Abel, and Abel said that, or God said concerning Abel's blood, that his blood was talking to him. So in the psychology of God, blood spoke to God. Blood was able to communicate with God. Now, I don't communicate with blood. I don't understand that. I would never even be able to understand somebody that would say somebody's blood was talking to them. But we have that when Cain killed Abel. So there's a few things that are there, and then of course the only thing as far as the sacrifice of Jesus is concerned, where blood was concerned, of course, goes back to the inception of the law, and then the sacrifices that were there to offer satisfaction for those laws was the sacrifice, the blood sacrifice of course of animals first, which in turn then was strictly as Paul taught us so clearly, was a type and shadow of the ultimate sacrifice of not just a human being, but see, all of this is intricately and inexorably tied together, because just the blood of another human being would not have any redemptive quality to it. But the blood of a man that was born, quote, of the Spirit, rather than being born of the seed of a man, which I don't claim to understand all of that actual taking place, and I know a lot of people get tripped up on whether or not that actually happened or not. But the issue is that without the virgin birth, the qualification for the blood sacrifice to do what it was intended to do, which was to redeem the world and to take away sin, just would not have been possible. So
blood must be a big issue to God, because, as you said, the first death that occurred biblically, there was shedding of blood. I mean, Cain could have strangled Abel and shed no blood, but there was blood that was spilled. And even in the procreation process, when a woman is initially penetrated, there is a blood discharge.
Yes.
So in the procreation process, in the giving of life, there is the shedding of blood.
Yeah.
And so we can learn a lot about the redemptive process through the natural process of the giving of life and the production of life.
Yeah, and I do believe that all of that says a lot. And I you know, just taking from, you know, maybe we do need to listen to blood. You know, I mean, God listened to blood to see what blood has to say. But quite obviously, it is the blood is dealt with as more than just a liquid, something in the body. I don't know of any other thing in the body that was ever made a reference to in the scriptures that it spoke to God, that it communicated to God. So that in and of itself places something about blood in a realm that may stay forever elusive from us as far as understanding it is concerned. But the one thing that is without dispute as far as Scripture is concerned, blood is elevated to a level that is almost in and of itself a life form.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you are very
welcome.
Thank
you, Pepe, for participating.
Yeah.
It was huge help.
All right, I'll sign off.
All right, buddy, we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Pep. Bye.
There is James Pep Washburn, ladies and gentlemen, from the great and apparently chilly state of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And now that line opens up for you at 1-800-436-3260. We want to hear from you tonight. You can see, and we've talked about this many times, how pivotal participation from the listeners is to spur on conversation about the gospel. We want to hear what you're thinking and what your questions are, and we have the toll-free line available for you. If you're listening live right now, and it is about 9:30 on the East Coast of the United States on Wednesday night, September 30th, if you're listening live, and we want to hear from you, we're asking you to pick up the phone and call and let us hear from you with a question, a comment, a perspective, an insight, 1-800-436-3260 is the toll-free number. Sean O'Halloran is waiting in studio in the Tampa Bay studio to hear from you, 1-800-436-3260. This is our gathering place, our virtual weekly gathering. And so often, Michael, people have said to us, where is there a place I can go to hear this kind of teaching? Well, while there may not be a physical location every week to go and to participate and to feel akin with like-minded people, this is a place where people can go. And when we hear from folks, it really adds, it's just like any other natural social gathering. The more the merrier, and it really adds a lot of color and a lot of perspective when people participate.
Oh, it absolutely does. You know, when we get questions like that, I think that's when, especially Pep's questions tonight, I think it makes me come to grips with the reality of what a fundamentalist I am as far as some of the most basic theology is concerned about about Jesus, about the blood, about virgin birth, about crucifixion, and the reality and the validity of these things. You know, it's it also, you know, came to me just a moment as we were talking when I spoke about my friend Carlton Pearson, and I made reference to the fact that he had moved away from belief in the virgin birth or the reality or the need for a blood sacrifice at all. And as he spoke openly about at our first Gospel Revolution Grace Convention here in Houston last November, and many of us had some question about what Carlton actually did believe, but there was nothing left for us to wonder about when we had our time with him. And I really respected the fact that he spoke and spoke clearly about what he did and did not believe. It's interesting that I can openly speak and say that I disagree with Carlton, and I think that Carlton has embraced something that is not the truth about the gospel, but he's had other people tell him that he was wrong, but everybody else that's told him he was wrong has told him he's going to hell for it.
Yeah.
And that he's a heretic, and that he is, that not only is he wrong, he's all of these other things also. I can tell you that I believe with all my heart that Carlton Pearson is wrong. But I also have to remind everyone and myself and Carlton that Carlton, according to what I understand the gospel to be, that a denial of the virgin birth, a denial of the need for a blood sacrifice, does not change Carlton's stance in the eyes of God as far as righteousness, perfection, and holiness is concerned. It doesn't change it at all. It's interesting to me that of all of the others who have disagreed with Carlton about so many things in his process of evolving in his beliefs, is that in every other situation that I would know of, they would completely, in all of these circumstances, those who believe in the blood, those who believe in the virgin birth, would say that him not believing in those things would totally disqualify him from redemption through the blood. But he is redeemed through the blood he does not believe in. He is made holy and righteous by the blood he now says was just a bloody mess 2,000 years ago, that was not God's plan.
Right.
It doesn't make any difference if Carlton says that the cross was a bloody mess that man came up with, that it was could not possibly be the plan of God. That doesn't upset God. That doesn't undo the plan of God. That doesn't undo redemption. Nothing can undo the work of the cross, the power of the blood. The old hymn we used to sing in church is still very real for me. There's power in the blood. And it's not quite exactly the way we taught it in the Word of Faith movement. I remember one of our friends coming and preaching at the church, and he was talking about, you know, just how built up in the spirit and praying in tongues and how that his life was completely exempt from everything that came to his life, including insects. He said, if an insect lands on me, he says, if a mosquito lands on me, he says, it's going to fly away singing, there's power in the blood. So even though I don't believe when a mosquito lands on me, it's going to fly away singing, there's power in the blood.
You don't?
No, I don't believe a mosquito sings at all. So. But
yeah, I've got some questions for God. And mosquitoes are at the top of the list.
The mosquito? Oh, yeah. Mosquito
like,
thing.
What the hell is that about? This is Glenn Klein Online, Michael Williams, Gospel Revolution Night across the planet. We want to hear from you tonight. 1-800-436-3260. 1-800-436-3260. We hope you got the e-newsletter that went out yesterday. And if you did not, please email us at webcast@gospelrevolution.com or go to the gospelrevolution.com website and sign up for the email so that when we communicate via the email, you will be sure to receive your updates. But we want to hear from you via email, as always, if you're listening live or on the archive. That is another way to communicate with us at webcast@gospelrevolution.com. webcast@gospelrevolution.com. And as we said before, if you're listening live, let us hear from you tonight. We still have about 25 minutes left to go in this edition of GKO. 1-800-436-3260. You know, you talk about the efficacy and the importance of the virgin birth, that we know that Miriam, the nice Jewish girl, who was approximately 13 years of age at the time of her impregnation with the Messiah of the world, if she would have procreated naturally, she would have spilled blood as a virgin. And so not only was the seed of the blood of Adam not involved that way, but there was literally no shedding of human blood, even in the procreation of the Savior, which is kind of an interesting fact in and of itself.
Yeah, you know, and there's probably a whole world to be understood just by realizing that concept. The blood speaks. You know, we could. The one thing I've learned tonight is that the blood does have something to say, and quite obviously, at least to God, if not to us. But evidently, it does have the ability to communicate. And if there's something to be learned, I think it would be worth our while to take a listen and see, you know, what blood actually communicates. I know that in the scientific and medical fields, there's just there's things about the blood that is are things that I will never ever be able to know that are known scientifically about it that really does speak of the truth of the gospel and the power of the blood, if you will.
Well, one thing's for sure: if they ever want to know what your condition is, they test your blood.
Yes, they do. And
they test.
Most anything that is going on in your body, they're going to find it in your blood. You know, if they don't have to test this is one thing that really blew me away, because, you know, we went through the whole thing of cancer in my family has just been rampant. And I remember aunts and uncles dying even before my mother passed away in 1966 with 7 different forms of cancer in her body. And even at that time, they did not know how to find cancer in the blood. They had to test the cancer, the growth itself, to see whether or not something was cancerous. And I remember when I first started hearing about these tests, the blood tests, that could tell you whether or not you had cancer just according to certain levels of things that were in the blood. I can't remember the there's some acronym for it, I'm sure, that I can't remember. And they can actually know where the cancer is. They know prostate cancer from certain levels of certain things in the blood. And I'm sure that's certainly still in its very, very early stages. So, the one thing that we're learning more and more of is that the blood really does speak. It tells you an awful lot of things. It tells doctors, as you stated, it tells doctors most everything about your body and about the condition of your body from head to toe.
And it reminds me of the biblical admonition that even nature itself proclaims the salvation and the work of God.
Yes,
I think that
absolutely.
Might tie into a little bit what Pat was talking about why some of these ancient cultures had an understanding of the importance of sacrifice and stressed it. There's just things about all human beings' experience that answer to people's quest for an assuaging of their guilt.
Yes, absolutely. And then to realize that there is, and I say this by experience, that there is a cancellation of guilt when you realize the power of the blood, that the blood does cleanse, not just in the eyes of God, but as we are transformed, as we are saved through the process of understanding what the blood has done, it can even wash away all feelings of guiltiness toward God altogether. And I know that one for a fact. I know that one for a fact myself because I experience it. I remember as I've gone through the understanding of these things that the point that I came to, which was the interesting thing to me, was that I first had to come to grips with the issue of confession of sins. And Glenn, it was not until I abandoned the doctrine of confessing my sins to God to have forgiveness that I that I was literally translated into another whole realm of thinking, which was free from guilt. I had no concept of being freed from guilt. I had no goal of being freed from guilt. I was taught that my guilt was the reality that I really did believe in God, that if I ever got to where I didn't feel guilty, it meant that something was wrong with me. So there was no attempt on my part to get to a point of being freed from guilt. But that process of that actually being washed, and Paul talks about it as being a washing that takes place in the soul and in the mind to cleanse us from a guilty conscience. That blood of Christ is able to cleanse, is able to purge our conscience from dead works and from
what
guilt.
What can wash away my sins?
Isn't it amazing?
But the blood of
see, this really, really does amaze me. That
what?
It really, really does amaze me that for most people to come to a point of separation from their affiliation with religious guilt, they normally have to become unbelievers. I think the most amazing thing has happened is that I maintain all of the basic fundamentals of the tenets of the faith, as far as from creation right straight through to the prophecies about Jesus, the virgin birth, the teachings of Christ, the crucifixion, the death, the burial, the resurrection, the seated at the right hand of the throne of God, all of those are perfectly in place as realities, spiritual realities for me. It amazes me that someone believes they have to set any of those aside to be free. And the fact of it is that everyone that I have seen who has set them aside, that they in turn become self-righteous in their own concept of where they are, and then become very condescending to everyone else because there's really no measure anymore. But thank God for the measure I am so glad to have the law of God imposed upon me, and that law that has replaced all laws, and that's the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus. You see, by that law, I know that we are all equal with God. We are all equal with each other. So there is nothing else that teaches that form of equality except the gospel. I don't know of anything else that teaches that form of equality. There is no religion on the earth that teaches that form of equality. Probably the kindest religion on earth that I know of is Buddhism. But if you listen closely to that, there's definitely different levels of spirituality and all of this that's being measured out, even though it's the kindest religion there. There still is nothing to set the measure to determine righteousness and holiness before God. But the gospel gives us that. So as people abandon things such as a belief in the true validity of the cross, even, and the shedding of blood, they are abandoning the only true measure by which we should take stock of one another and of ourselves in relationship to God. And it leaves us in another sea, a different sea than the sea of Christian self-righteousness, but it just simply goes right on into a whole different realm of self-righteousness.
Right.
I remember us talking about the forum, you know, that Deepak Chopra was on, and with the prostitute, the preacher, and Carlton and Deepak Chopra. And I remember watching that debate about the existence of the devil, which was on a newscast, a news show at least. And I watched that, and when I saw the condescending self-righteousness that was coming across from Deepak, It just blew me away, because this is the man who's supposed to be in that elevated position that just doesn't view anybody differently. So there is the pretense of equality there. But there's not. It's just not there. There was contempt, if anything else, but they couldn't say for what. Now, I do hold in contempt all beliefs that do not hold everyone, that does not hold everyone as equal in the eyes of God and in holiness and in righteousness. But to hold contempt for a group of people because of what they believe, that's another whole thing altogether.
Right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got about 10 more minutes left on, and we're happy to welcome online another Gospel Revolution All-Star, our Stockton, California correspondent. Haven't heard from him for a while, but glad that he took the time to call tonight, Mr. Abraham Mackey. Hey, Abe!
Hey, Glenn and Michael.
What
hey,
a pleasure
Abraham.
To hear your
Good
voice.
To hear from
How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm very thankful. In fact, you were talking about the blood, and I was going to say my blood has been talking to me.
Well,
yeah,
has it been communicating good things to you or something bad?
No, actually, it was communicating 115 over 74.
Ah, that's very good.
That's pretty good. I needed a little help to get there, but I'm glad for that reading. No,
yes, well, I went through that myself, and I understand the pride in those one teens and 70s readings for sure.
Yes, well,
congratulations.
I mean, it's pride, it's gratitude, I guess. here's my. I've really been boiling it down to simple things for myself, and to preface the simplicity that I'm viewing things in, I'll take it back to after listening and listening and listening, I think we went through every one of your recordings that we had access to, Michael. And the day came, and you, I think I've shared this with you once or twice. The day came, I was driving down one of the Stockton, California streets, and suddenly it's just like the light bulb went on in my head.
Yeah.
That I am not obligated by God to do anything.
Yeah.
I am free. Well, you know, that thought and the ideas behind it have been working in me now for, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 months. And if I cannot know something absolutely, I am going to put it in this wonderful frame called, I don't know.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
And I am so at peace not having to know. Because if I can't know it, in other words, anything that I cannot know personally, I am just, I'm going to say, well, that's interesting, or that's fine. I don't have to, get upset over it, or get, I can put it in the I don't know. And so, it's like I've taken God, or my concept of God, and I, just jokingly, I said to Mary, I said, I threw the God that was holding me to all these standards, I threw him under the bus. And if he's really God, he'll be okay. And in the meantime, I'm enjoying life.
Yeah, that is the end result, isn't it? It is to... at least where life is concerned, if it is enjoyable, at least you can enjoy it.
Yeah,
there are people,
yeah,
though, that
exactly.
have a pleasant life who can't enjoy it. I mean,
well,
it's one
I
thing
know.
When life's going wrong.
It's all wrapped up in their head.
Yes, absolutely. It's one thing when things are going wrong and you have actual situations to deal with that's causing heartache. But it's another thing to have a life where that things are relatively in good shape and you're still in misery.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's where I lived for many years as a with my identity in place as a born-again, spirit-filled Christian. An elder in the church, a Christian head of the household, and unhappy man. And I had no idea why.
Yeah.
Except that I basically figured I was a failure, and God knew it, and he was probably going to find a way to drag me into heaven someday anyway and, you know, kind of put me with clothespins on the line and says, when you dry out, son, you'll be okay.
Yeah.
But I really was not happy.
Yeah, isn't that unfortunate to
I think
to carry to carry an unhappiness in you that has nothing to do with your circumstances at all?
No, it had to do with the way I conceptualized God and me. And that concept was reinforced in church every week because it was, you know, the standards. If you're really going to be, you know, the man of God, you're going to do this. You're going to be in the Word. You're going to be on your knees. You're going to be reaching out. You're going to be all this. And I failed on every front.
What do you guys
well,
think, though, for those, especially those, Michael and Abraham, that have succeeded, at least on the surface, whether they're being honest with themselves or with other people or not, but the professional ministry, who has made their money. They have their mansions, they have their cars, they have their private jets, and they say to us, the reason that you have gotten into this particular doctrine and this so-called gospel is because you guys couldn't hack it. You just didn't have it in you.
Well, I would say to him, I'd say, go for it, fellow. Have at it. Because you're exactly right. I don't have it in me. In fact, I don't think that person can be honest, truly honest, and therefore free, trying to keep up that front anyway. To me, my freedom is, I don't know. I don't have to. I mean, if you say, okay, this is the way it is. This is this is how the gospel works. This is how God works. I already know you're flying by the seat of your pants because God is bigger than anything you've ever thought of in your entire life.
Very true. I agree with that. And, the interesting thing also, Abraham, is that you and I were those people who said that others just couldn't hack it.
Absolutely.
I mean, that was our answer to those people who went another way with a belief that about the grace of God, even just that subject alone.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they would question it based on that is certainly not a surprise, because I did it. I questioned it based on that. While I knew in my own heart that I was not measuring up, I knew I wasn't. And as much as they could possibly have known it, I knew it myself. And I think they know it too.
Yeah, it may be a confusing issue, because if everything inside of you is where you're continually tempering your beliefs, where you're really striving to be the Christian that you believe a Christian is supposed to be, that God wants you to be, that is an entire mind trip. That, as far as I know, maybe God is in all that stuff, but I can't know it. I can't know it beyond a shadow of a doubt, because all the effort I put in all those years in very sincere, very dedicated to the best of my ability, I came away realizing that, I don't know if you've got it right.
Yeah.
And one of the other things, too, fellas, is that when you're in evangelicalism or any religious doctrine, there's always the next question that is imponderable, and they're always searching for an answer to why Christ hasn't come back, why the person didn't get healed, why the financial breakthrough, why the marriage didn't come back together. But as we address the questions of the gospel, it's every single time, it's because there's such consistency and wholeness in the message, it's, yes, that makes sense. Yes, that makes sense. Yes, I understand that. And it's just a continuing uncovering of this beautiful message of the righteousness and the perfection of God through Christ that has been freely given to all of humanity. There's no disagreement. Beautiful.
Yes, no conflict either in doctrine, and that to me is monumental, and it should be monumental in the mind of anyone. Is that I know beyond the shadow of a doubt that I do not teach one single conflicting doctrine. And if I do, I will become aware of it, and I'll stop it. I've done it many times before, and but in as I just file through the theology and the doctrines of the gospel, I can't find one single conflicting statement. And if anybody can, I want them to bring it to my attention, because I want to know that. I want to know where the inconsistency and the conflict is, because I lived there for so many years, I don't ever want to stand in that position anymore.
Right. The gospel is in conflict with legalism and with self-righteousness.
Absolutely.
And any doctrine that would put people under any obligation, as you said, Abraham, to do anything for God. It is in stark contrast to that. But in and of itself, there is nothing that portends to Christ's sacrifice and to the foreshadowing and the commentaries on the scriptures and on the gospel that is in conflict at all.
Yeah, no, it really is amazing.
Abraham, thank you for participating.
Hey, thank you, guys.
Thanks, Abraham. You took us right up to the end of the show.
And the show goes on.
That's right.
And the show rolls on.
It's not,
and congratulations on the blood pressure.
It's not curtains yet. All right,
thanks,
guys.
Buddy.
Thank you so much for the few minutes.
Let us hear from you frequently.
All right. Thanks, Glenn. Thanks for
All right, good night. Give our love to Mary.
For the show. I will.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye, Abraham.
Here's Abraham Mackey from the West Coast.
Our good friend from the West Coast.
This is Glenn Klein online from the East Coast, talking to Michael Williams in the plains of Houston. Heard from Pep Washburn tonight in the upper Midwest in Wisconsin, and we hope you enjoyed the webcast. And, Michael, we hope people are making their plans to attend the convention. When a person saturates themselves for a weekend in this, with like-minded folks who come together without any condemnation, without any judgment, it's really quite an experience. We had a great time last year. Go to the website at gospelrevolution.com for all the information about the second Gospel Revolution Convention. Hebrews Revealed. See, we came up with a nice theme. Hebrews Revealed. Michael's going to be teaching verse by verse the doctrines that are taught in the book of Hebrews that so long, Michael, have been perverted by religion to keep people in bondage and legalism. And the ironic thing is that those are the very verses that actually proclaim our freedom in Christ.
It absolutely does. And this will be a lifetime work for me. And I am excited about it. If I did not know the Holy Ghost as the great teacher, I would be probably treading around a lot of fear about it. But my years of experience as the Holy Ghost being the great teacher, a man without a high school diploma, never been to a day of Bible school in his life, I really don't have any concern about teaching the entire book of Hebrews, chapter 1, verse 1, right straight through the last verse of chapter 13.
And we'll have other speakers as well, but it's November 12th through the 15th in beautiful Houston, Texas, at the Marriott North at Greenpoint. Very lovely facility. Give us a call. You can call Michael directly at 281-955-1910. To talk to him about it or anything else for that matter, 281-955-1910, or email us at webcast@gospelrevolution.com, or just go to the website. The information is there at gospelrevolution.com, as well as a couple of new teaching series that are offered, Ministry Beyond Relief, not Beyond Relief, Bringing Relief.
Bringing Relief.
Ministry Bringing Relief. And in a twinkling of an eye, a view of history is being offered at the website as well. All right, well, it's Dawn's and my 26th wedding anniversary tomorrow.
Yay.
So we're going to be celebrating 26 years of marital bliss? He said, by faith.
I said, have fun.
We will. And it's also our good buddy George Howell's birthday tomorrow, we learned.
George
Howell,
happy birthday,
boldgrace.com. Go to boldgrace.com and wish George a happy birthday. Happy birthday, George.
Happy birthday to George.
That's all you got?
That's it.
All right, well, that's going to do it for us tonight on this edition of the Gospel Revolution webcast. Thanks to Sean O'Halloran for producing and engineering in our studios in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hope you enjoyed the webcast. Until next time, this is Glenn Klein Online saying, Shalom, everybody!